This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's Morning Show, Now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. It's been a busy weekend on the news front. Michelle McQuigg is the weekend news editor at the Canadian Press and is here to offer up a recap. Hey, good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Dave.
So, Michelle, the federal government is poised to release some of the residential school records it's been withholding to a National Archives Center. Michelle, do we have a sense of the volume of these records and what they contain?
Yeah, well, this is actually quite an interesting reversal. In terms of the volume, not totally sure just yet. There's still some details that need to emerge about exactly which documents and how many are going to be released. But one really key piece that we've been told in an interview with the Indigenous Affairs Minister, Mark Miller, is that one of the key pieces being released will be school narratives. And these are records that were kept on all of the residential school facilities that were run by the Catholic Church. And they document it all. They document the school's history. They list the administrators. They list attendance and all the students who were there. And they are also supposed to contain incident reports of various abuse cases and allegations. So that is really going to be an important piece of it. And it's one of the documents that the Truth and Reconciliation Center has been calling for quite some time.
Along those lines, what kind of pressure has been mounting to release these records?
Quite a lot, actually. This is one of those calls that's not new. There was a court case dating back to 2015, in fact, about that involved getting the Catholic Church to even potentially pay some compensation to people. So the calls for this are not unique or novel in any real way, except for the fact that the discovery of unmarked graves earlier this year really, really galvanized people and renewed those calls and had them coming from some different quarters. So it was not, of course, unusual to hear them coming from Indigenous groups or allies and advocates who were affiliated with those groups. But now, in light of the discovery of unmarked graves, they were coming from much further afield. They were coming from church critics. They were coming from everyday Canadians who were just horrified by the stories that were coming to light. So that pressure really was starting to build.
You mentioned that Crown Indigenous Relations Minister Mark Miller is the one who revealed these documents would be given to this archival unit. Did he offer up any rationale for why the federal government has changed their stance on this?
Yeah, it's actually kind of interesting to read that. Basically, in the Coles Notes version of it is that he says that the moral obligation to Indigenous people outweighs any previous commitments they might have had with the Catholic Church to keep those records under wraps. And that is the reason he's giving, at least, for this change of heart. There's also a bit of an effort to blame the previous administration, which, of course, is not super unusual in the world of politics. This has to go back to the court case I referenced in 2015 and the whole issue of appealing that case and keeping records closed. There was a bit of an effort to pivot that and put it back on the Harper administration, but Mark Miller essentially said that Canada's made mistakes and releasing those documents is going to be a way to try to redress those.
Michelle, let's move on to another thorny issue for the federal government. Mm-hmm. The veterans watchdogs says a lack of action from Ottawa is forcing many veterans and their loved ones to fight to access federal support and services. Ombudsman Nishika Jardine says the government is increasingly ignoring her guidance as well. So what kind of issues have veterans been bringing forward?
Well, a lot of the issues are things that we've heard about, and that I have to make a plug for my colleague Lee Bertheum, who's done a lot of really excellent work on that this year in particular. He did a whole series on Remembrance Day, documenting things like long wait times for benefits, like lack of support for caregivers, like the backlog in terms of processing even routine claims. All these things are pretty well documented now. And Nishika Jardine is talking about how her office, as the Veterans Ombud, she's trying to drop the term ombudsman since she's the first woman to hold the post, has been making recommendations for the past 4 years that have been increasingly disregarded. She says that of the 26 recommendations put forward in that four-year time period from 2017 until now, only six actually got acted on. So that's the kind of issue we're dealing with, things that really have a direct impact on veterans' lives and their families.
I want to get to ombudsman versus ombudswoman versus ombud in a second, because I think language is fascinating. But I've got one more follow-up for you. Mm. What kind of advice and guidance has the government been ignoring?
We don't have specific examples of the text of the 26 recommendations, for instance, but they do focus on things like providing mental health support to family members, more equitable access to financial assistance and support for disabled veterans, and making sure that veterans are not waiting for months or for years for help. And another troubling wrinkle in all of this is Nishika Jardine told Lee, my colleague, that there's been increasing difficulty for everyone, but it's particularly for women and for Francophones. Mm. So that's a bit troubling.
So Michelle, just very quickly here on the topic of ombudsman versus ombudswoman versus ombudsperson, so often in the way in which as media members we try to communicate with people, it requires a certain shorthand or a colloquialism. How do you think we can actually sort of shift people away from understanding? Because even this morning, as I was writing this out, I'm like, ooh, do I put ombudsman in the thing on our topic sheets on the screen? Because people understand what ombudsman means. If I just write ombud, will they get it? How do you think we can sort of evolve that language in real time?
It's really funny that you mentioned that, because I had a similar reaction. This story was not, I did not edit this story. This was written during the week by Lee and edited by his editors in Ottawa. So I was looking at the wire and I see this ombud and I'm like, is that a typo? What's going on here? Then you read the story and it's, you know, nicely explained that this is a deliberate choice she's making to shift that language. So honestly, I'm kind of the view that the best way to get the language into the vernacular is just to use it and get, mm-hmm. you know, get the exposure out there and have people see it in print and hear it on air and gradually get used to it. But it's definitely going to take a while.
Yeah,
not always an organic process.
Well, very good. We'll work on that one together. We'll work on that one together. Teamwork through.
Deal.
And through.
You're on.
All right, Michelle. One more topic here, and this one is a very significant one, and it's a very serious one. Today marks the 32nd anniversary of the École Polytechnique massacre in Montreal. We know there's going to be ceremonies, vigils, and some really significant conversations about violence against women happening today. But is there anything that you want to flag for us and bring to our attention?
Just the fact that, as a lot of women's rights advocates are pointing out, 32 years on, more than three decades in, and we're seeing spikes in femicide. We're seeing very little action in terms of addressing the root causes of what came about in 1989, which was a misogynistic attack. A lot of people have sounded alarms about how COVID has greatly exacerbated the risk that a lot of women are in right now, especially if they're in abusive situations and they're largely staying home or left under more control of their abusers. So things are not good. And this very somber anniversary, which is difficult at the best of times, is maybe particularly significant now. At the same time, there is a bit of a silver lining. If you were to look up a story that my colleague Morgan Lowry wrote yesterday, she did quite a nice job looking at some of these issues. And Nathalie Prévost, who's one of the survivors of the École Polytechnique shooting, she's been a very vocal gun control advocate and speaking out a lot about her experiences. She's been talking also about how she's feeling a little more hope than she ever has before, despite all these grim things I just mentioned, because of the fact that there has been increased scrutiny and increased conversation about these issues, and also some of the campaign promises out of the federal election. The Liberals have been talking about banning assault-style weapons and perhaps broadening some gun control measures, and that is a cause of hope to her, at least, although, of course, it's likely to encounter quite a bit of political opposition. Lots to think about, but, of course, we need to always remember the 14 people who were killed 32 years ago today.
You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.